science, learning, business, community. You. Welcome to Think Works, the podcast for people who like to think. Because thinking is the hardest work there is. Come with us on a journey into the world of ideas with your host, Darren Smithson.
Hello and welcome to ThinkWorks, a place where we do all the heavy lifting when it comes to thinking. And today we're plunging into the dark, mist-shrouded world of Bram Stoker's Dracula, a novel that continues to haunt and inspire over a century later than its publication. And we've touched upon gothic monsters already in previous episodes. We've already talked about Frankenstein, for example, and the lasting legacy of that particular piece of work. But we didn't really go into any detail in the monster motif one about Dracula, and there's so much to tease out about the Good Count. So without further ado, shall we begin? Now, Dracula, first published in 1897, written of course by Stoker, is much more than just a chilling tale of a vampire's quest to conquer London. It's a rich tapestry of themes, many of which explore sexual repression and societal taboos. In the novel, vampirism actually becomes a metaphor for forbidden encounters and suppressed desires. The act of blood drinking serves as a potent symbol for life and vitality and even the very soul. And it's a theme that's deeply intertwined, I think, with the human fears of contamination and moral decay that abounded during the Victorian era. So let's start by peeling back those layers of Bram Stoker's Dracula and the underlying themes that extend beyond the thrilling horror of vampires themselves. And one of the most compelling aspects of that narrative is its exploration of sexual repression, societal taboos. And the late 19th century was really characterized by a strict moral code and rigid societal expectation concerning sexuality, at least on the surface, because we all know that peer underneath that petticoat of the Victorian era and slums and sex dens and opium dens and all this, you know, where people with money were actually going and actually doing all their underground sexual activity and underground drug usage and lack of moral fibre, it was there, but it was as far as the surface was concerned, it couldn't be, and an individual couldn't be seen to be supporting those kind of places. Now, Stoker uses that backdrop really to highlight society's fears and hidden desires through these metaphors that he intricately weaves within the tale of the Count. So, is vampirism a metaphor for forbidden desire? Yes, it is, because it serves as a potent metaphor in many ways for forbidden desires and sexual deviance. The exchange of blood becomes the substitute for intimacy, symbolizing both the allure and the danger of unchecked desire. And this can be seen in the intense, often sensual descriptions of Dracula's encounters with his victims, which possess an erotic undertone reflecting hidden carnal desires. And the novel portrays these interactions as both enticing and corrupting. It blurs the line between pleasure and pain and pleasure and sin. And the act of the penetration, the fangs biting into the necks or into the breasts of women in particular, that kind of penetration act is just a clear metaphor for the sexual power and the potency of this foreign count, Count Dracula. You've also got the idea of repression and liberation. So characters such as Lucy Westenra and Mina Harker, they become focal points really in this exploration of repression and liberation. Lucy's transformation from a virtuous, virginal, Victorian lady into a sexually voracious vampire hints at the era's anxieties about female sexuality. Her eventual staking, a violent act of penetration, in itself can be interpreted as society's attempts to suppress and control female desire within the boundaries of acceptable norms. Similarly, the character of Mina is caught between archetypal roles of the Madonna and the whore, as she's depicted as pure and virtuous, yet becomes subject to Dracula's influence. Her struggle and the eventual redemption signify an ongoing tension between liberation and societal expectation. Women were starting to find their voice, and the people in power didn't really like that. And I think this is what's reflected in this whole relationship and the changes that Mina goes through as she embraces the Count's influence. And that leads directly into the societal fears of contamination. The theme of blood as a life source not only signifies vitality, but also purity and contamination of that purity. As Dracula spreads his influence, therefore, he threatens that racial and moral purity, which were superficially the cornerstones of Victorian society. This fear of contamination just reflects those broader anxieties about immigration, the other, the breakdown of social order, and the transfusion scene's a charge of anxiety about mixing blood, underscoring fears of racial mixing and moral decay. And when you take a look at what the fearmongers are trying to do today, you can see that this fear is always there. It's still here. This fear of the unknown, this fear of the alien, the fear of the something different that could come into our society and change it. And, you know, whether, you know, I mean, taking out the whole context of the religious persecution and the religious mission, so-called religious mission, of extremists, even just that normal mixing of different beliefs and different types of bloodlines and different hues of skin colour, it all feeds into this prejudice that is still here. And it was definitely Dracula, the book, was trying to reflect and engage in conversation upon those kind of anxieties and fears. Sadly, we're not clever enough today, I don't think, as a society, to really have intelligent conversations about what's going on with the world and about what's going on with this finding groups to blame, which is just straight out of the Nazi playbook, if you want to, you know, really go down that route. And we've got to stop trying to actually demonize entire groups of people, or ethnic groups in particular, because of the actions of a few extremists. And that's the problem that we have. We don't. We tend to see everyone under the same kind of banner. If they belong under a grouping of a religious group, or of an ethnic group, or a country group, or a racial group. And as a society, we're not being nuanced enough in our reaction, or in our discussion, or in our engagement with these different issues and different anxieties and different influences that are coming our way. And it's something that obviously people that want to exploit those anxieties and exploit those fears and exploit those prejudices are working really hard to keep that division going, because it comes back to that old axiom, divide and rule. And that's exactly what is happening in the world right now. Going back to Dracula then, you've got Stoker cleverly using all those ideas of his time, the issues that they were facing, which are similar to what we're facing today, to subtly criticise the repressive norms of his time. While Dracula is a figure of terror, he also represents an irresistible allure to explore or embrace what is forbidden. And it challenging society by challenging the characters, it challenges society by extension and its rigid codes. And that is an undercurrent, a subtext that's going on within Dracula all the while. Now, when you come to read Dracula, Bram Stoker's narrative style is quite, it's not archaic, but it's kind of a bridge between the old style of writing and a newer, more modern narrative style. And so it can be a little bit difficult at first when you pick up Dracula to read through it, because the style is a little different from what you might be used to. But it's well worth persevering, because suddenly you'll get the flow of it and you'll understand the different narrative contexts and stylizations that were around at that time. And Bram Stoker was definitely a bridge between the kind of Mary Shelley approach to narrative to the Conan Doyle approach to narrative. So he's a kind of bridge there. But once you actually get into it, you will see that he is asking you to ponder psychological and societal undercurrents. He is actually trying to get you to think about how these intricate themes reflect on not only Victorian life, but actually his shadow now extends into today, as we've said, and it's actually a really good way to start thinking and positing questions and conversations about what's happening in the world today. Now, going back to its time, however, and its impact on the Gothic movement in particular, and its reception and critique, Dracula played a pivotal role in reinvigorating the Gothic literature of its time. It blends the supernatural and the modern. It creates a narrative that is both familiar and terrifyingly new. It paved the way, really, for contemporary horror, influencing writers like Anne Rice and Stephen King, who definitely blend the Gothic with modern themes in their own narratives of vampires and supernatural horror. Now, despite the fact that Dracula is definitely Bram Stoker's magnum opus and invigorated the Gothic genre, when it was first released and graced the literary world, the reception was mixed, although noticeably it did pique interest. Readers were captivated by its atmospheric tension and thrilling narrative, dialoguing with existing fears of that societal upheaval and the unknown, and many found themselves drawn into its intense blend of fantasy and horror that transcended the conventional boundaries of Gothic fiction of the time. However, critics at the time offered varied opinions. Some praised Stoker for his new style of storytelling, that bridge that I mentioned earlier, and the ability to fuse modern-day context with time-honoured Gothic elements, and they lauded his masterful use of epistolary forms, which offered multiple perspectives and added depth to the narrative's suspense. Conversely, however, others critiqued it for a lack of originality, drawing parallels to previous works like The Vampire by John Polidori. But in the realm of his literary peers, Dracula was both a curiosity and a subject of envy. H.G. Wells and Arthur Conan Doyle, for instance, recognised the novel's potential and unique take on the monstrous motif, which we discussed in the last episode. And the novel helped elevate Stoker's status, albeit after his death, as an influential figure in literature. Stoker's peers appreciated the novel's ability to weave those contemporary fears of invasion and otherness and the fear of the foreign into a narrative that felt both intimate and epic. And Dracula profoundly impacted the Gothic movement by revitalizing it with elements of modernity. Stoker's use of technologies like the phonograph and telegram set a new precedent for incorporating contemporary advancements into Gothic narratives. And it blended really that kind of the new and the old world, and he does it masterfully. It expanded the thematic repertoire of the Gothic to include psychological complexity and modern scientific anxiety, paving the way for future works that explored similar themes. The novel's success in entwining that horror with themes of scientific progress and its reflection of societal fears not only cemented Dracula as a staple of Gothic literature, but it influenced subsequent narratives that looked to blend Gothic horror with modern-day relevance. As the world opened up, as communication improved across the world, as ships became faster and able to link the world's trade and commerce and also tourists much more effectively and easily, the ability of writers to be able to blend Gothic horror with modern-day relevance really stemmed from that initial piece of work by Bram Stoker in Dracula. Mary Shelley's Frankenstein earlier, of course, attempted to do exactly that, but the difference is, I think, with Dracula is that it lent into a more modern narrative style, whereas Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which I absolutely adore and love to bits, was very much steeped in the writing style of her period. But in effect, what you have to look at with Dracula is that it did shape later horror genres, soundtracking the cultural evolution of horror from print, indeed, to silver screen, as demonstrated in the legacy of adaptations following the novel's release. I guess what I'm trying to say is really that Dracula was more than just a story of vampires. It was a social commentary, a catalyst for innovation within Gothic literature, but that bridge between the classic and the contemporary. Its legacy of being both revered and contested at its time of release only adds, I think, to its mystique and lasting impact. Now, if we look at some of that impact, I mean, the novel, it extends beyond literature into film, television, comics have been adapted. You've got to remember The Chilling Silence of Nosferatu, directed by F.W. Murnau, an early cinematic tribute, possibly, to Stoker's novel. But the iconic 1931 Dracula film starring Bela Lugosi, everyone, they may not have seen the movie, but just about everyone in the Western world in particular will know the name Bela Lugosi and will know that he played the Count, Count Dracula. He's become the archetypal portrayal, the image of the Count with a Transylvanian accent and flowing cloak. And these adaptations often emphasise the horror, offering a lens through which the darker shades of Stoker's themes can be explored. There is still a lot, even in those original Universal movies, there's still that kind of the sensuality of the Count, the mixing of blood, the blood as a vital source of life, and the how it can be weakened by mixing. All these themes are explored even in the movies. It's quite astounding, really. But you've also got to look at not just the films. I'm going to put some comic book images in there, because every time I do an episode of ThinkWorks, regular listeners will know I also do a corresponding post in the forum, the ThinkWorks forum. And so in that corresponding post for this episode, I will be putting some of the glorious images from film, including Christopher Lee and Bela Lugosi, etc., and also into the comic adaptations that Marvel Comics in particular in the 70s really did exceptionally well, in both a colour version and a more mature black and white magazine version, which was a bit more gritty, a bit more earthy and tied into the original, the real meaning of what the Count meant from Bram Stoker's point of view. The colour comic Tomb of Dracula was just a massive success at the time. It lasted, I think it was over 80 issues for a horror comic. Trust me, that is not bad going. But the stories and the artwork and everything are all captured, and the showdown between Frankenstein and Dracula in those comics is one of my all-time favourite story arcs. Absolutely superb. But in comic form in particular, the Count really does seem to come alive and leap off the pages with that brooding, amoral. He's not evil. The Count does not perceive himself to be evil. He perceives himself to be superior to humanity. Humanity is there to serve him and his needs. But he has a code of conduct even within that. And that is something that the Marvel Comics adaptation in particular have kind of teased out. So he's not really a villain. He's definitely not a hero. He's not even an anti-hero. But he's the Count. And I think that's an absolutely amazing place to put him. And how the writers did that, I think, is absolutely astonishing. But the artist that captured, and Gene Colan in particular, the artist that did the colour work, is he's really the definitive portrayal of the Count in the comic book form in the 70s. But even today, there are adaptations that appear. Dracula appears in modern TV series like Buffy. He appeared in an episode in that. He appears, as I mentioned, in other supernatural type TV series. And you've got to watch out for the references to him. He always seems to be there, somewhere in the background. And the whole idea of having an alpha vampire, which was explored, obviously, within the Supernatural TV series. And when all said and done, that's what keeps Dracula relevant. It's that universal fear that it encapsulates both mortality, the unknown. It also includes the thin line between civilization and savagery. It's all there. It keeps it relevant. And Stoker's work has inspired, as I said, countless retellings from TV series like Castlevania to musicals, even Saturday morning cartoons, comics, books, stories, films. This narrative flexibility just demonstrates how culturally universal Bram Stoker's Dracula and his creation really is. And it would be remiss of me not to really mention some of the influences that he's had on other creations. So his narrative style and character creation influenced writers like H.P. Lovecraft, for example, who admires Stoker's ability to imbue palpable dread and atmosphere into his narratives, something that Lovecraft emulated in crafting his own eerie tales. Stephen King Salem's Lot pays homage to the vampire mythos by introducing vampirism to modern day settings, drawing clear inspirations from Stoker's formula of horror embedded in domesticity, in the norm, in the modern, in the real world. And so, really then, I guess the last question we need to ask is, why does Dracula endure? Perhaps it's more than that thirst for blood. It quenches our own thirst for stories that delve deep into the psyche. It explores fears and fantasies, especially those that make us human. And I think we need to consider how this story whispers to the shadows inside us. I mentioned how fearmongers and the people that are trying to divide to rule are appealing to those base fears and anxieties about the strange, the foreign, the contamination of the other. It's all part and parcel of modern societal fears and anxieties and prejudices in particular. And we can't get away from that. And I think that's why Dracula, both the work, the literary work of Bram Stoker and its modern interpretations, speak so much to us, because they touch upon that and they make us ponder our mortality in a world that is forever changing quite dramatically, and our own limitations within that. Hope you've enjoyed that. And as I said, as always, there's a corresponding post for this episode. If you go to darreninform.com/thinkworksforum, you'll see that there is a post specifically for this Dracula episode. If you also look in the forum, you'll see all the other episodes have got their own corresponding posts. You can go back at any time and join in a discussion or post your own views on a particular idea or on Dracula in particular when you get to this episode. Just what is your favourite interpretation of the Count? Why did that interpretation speak to you? I'd love to know. I'd love to hear all that. And if you go back and listen to the Frankenstein episode or the Star Trek episode or some of the scientific or philosophical episodes I've done, just give me your views and your ideas and other ideas of what you'd like me to consider as well. I would love to hear from you. Until then, a couple of things to bear in mind. Please stay safe. It's a crazy world out there. It's getting crazier by the moment. But at the same time that you are making sure you're safe, keep asking questions. It's really important that we don't ever become afraid of asking the powers that be questions that are on our mind. Because once that happens, we're no longer living in a free world. We're living in a dictatorship. And that is a scary place to be. So keep asking questions, keep pondering questions to me. If there's anything on any subject that you've heard in any of the episodes of ThinkWorks, I would love to hear you ask me a question so that I can get back to you and give you my view or my answer. And that's why ThinkWorks is here. It's to get people thinking outside the box and not just taking one view, but trying to take in several and then coming to your own conclusion. And you can only do that if you ask questions. Take care, everyone, and I'll see you next week.
If you would like to find out more, or join in with the conversation, our forum has a corresponding post for you to comment in. Simply go to darreninform.com/thinkworksforum and join in the fun. Or you can join the Facebook page by searching for at @DarrenInform for news, tips and other helpful strategies. The show was hosted by Darren Smithson, and the music is by Alexander Nakarada. You have been listening to ThinkWorks, the podcast for thinkers.